You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nikita Petrov, well-known member of the Non-Zero team, also proprietor of the Psychopolitica Substack newsletter, well worth checking out. And I bring good news to the world. You have a world-saving idea that cuts across AI and war
right.
in a constructive way, which is good because there's been some, kind of alarming news on both fronts lately. People are probably familiar with the Iran war. They're probably familiar with this big Mythos thing that came out of Anthropic's AI lab. In any event, we'll catch people up on that. But I just want to say, I just want to thank you in advance, Nikita, for having the idea that's going to save the world.
Somebody has to, right?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, like, they're so busy, like, oh, climbing the career ladder, making money. But you're not making any money. You're not making any progress on the career ladder. So you got a lot of time on your hands, right?
I'm in the south of Spain and I have a dog that needs walking. So I spend a lot of my time walking in the sun in the streets of Malaga. There's nothing to do but think about world-saving ideas.
You don't listen to podcasts while you walk your dog?
I don't have many that I listen to anymore. I got tired of most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And audiobooks, I get distracted too easily. Like with podcasts, you can zone out a little bit. I don't know what it is about the density of information, but with an audiobook, like I get distracted and then I miss half a page and that's not okay.
Actually, toward the end of this conversation, maybe I can talk about a couple of audiobooks I've either finished or I'm in the middle of. One on John Adams, one on Adolf Hitler, and one on Demis Hassabis.
Good combo.
The head of Google DeepMind. So, let me catch people up on recent events in these two relevant realms. First of all, as probably everybody knows, Trump, after spending, 18 hours of negotiation that took the Obama administration like 18 years of negotiation to solve, Trump kind of acted as if he had given up and it was over. And J.D. Vance was like, we put our offer on the table. Let us know whether you accept or decline. And then Trump imposed a blockade on Iranian ports, which, of course, is an act of war. Nothing unusual about waging war on Iran, but this was during a ceasefire. And Iran made alarming noises about how they would respond to that by basically making other ports in the area inoperable, which is, probably a euphemism. Then a couple of things happened that I think account for the fact that the price of oil is not higher than it is now. As of when we started taping, it was, high 90s, but not as high as it had been, not as high as you might think, given the news that, Trump was saying, well, we're going to make sure the Strait of Hormuz is closed. That'll show Iran not to close it. And I think the developments are, first of all, there was a report that Saudi Arabia was urging Trump to rethink the blockade. I wondered if that story was leaked to reassure markets. I don't know. There was also a story that could have been leaked to make negotiations seem more soluble than people might have thought. And that was the news that, according to this New York Times story, at least, the big remaining issue was Trump wanted Iran to flat out suspend enrichment at any level for 20 years. Iran was willing to go 5 years. And I think people thought, well, maybe they can work that out. Maybe they can compromise on that, right? Now, I don't think that is the only remaining issue. But in any event, that may account for the relatively cheerful mood of the market, so far as I can tell. This idea of no enrichment at all would be new. What the Obama deal had done was say you can enrich at a very low level, like 3% or something. But you're going to be so comprehensively monitored and inspected that we will know exactly what you're doing. If you suddenly decided to break out and try to get a nuclear weapon, it would take you, you know, months and months to get the weapons-grade uranium, more months to turn it into weapon, be plenty of time for, you know, Israel to do what it would inevitably do under those circumstances. In fact, you wouldn't need that much time, but that was the idea. So, and I assume the Trump deal would include that beyond any period of flat-out moratorium on any kind of enrichment, which, again, would be a new concession on Iran's part. Okay, so there's that. That's where we are on that.
I saw a headline. Did you see this? Am I getting this right? That there was a Chinese ship that went through the strait after Trump announced the blockade?
Was that like a day or two ago?
The story I saw was like 7 hours ago, but it references Bloomberg. Let me see. April 14. Yeah, so it's like 12 hours ago, I guess.
Do you know if it was going in or coming out?
I
will say that in a clarification of the blockade, I think the Trump administration said, well, if they want to go to the Strait of Hormuz to a non-Iranian port, we'll permit that or come out from one, I believe. So that could account for... I have not heard that report. I did hear that maybe an Iranian, either an Iranian kind of related tanker, either coming from an Iranian port or maybe flat out Iranian or something, had turned back, had started to come out, had turned back in the face of the blockade. So they were respecting the blockade for the time being.
When I saw that headline, what it made me think is enforcement. Like when Iran closes the strait, Iran is already at war. It's bombing neighboring countries. It is a logical step, like to say we're going to, you know, shoot or bomb or whatever at a ship if it goes through, if it tries to go through. For the U.S. to say that to like China, you know, a Chinese tanker we're going to attack.
Yeah,
it seems like a higher bar, like a scarier escalation and harder to follow through on, isn't it?
People who are actual experts, unlike you and me, raised that very question. Are you sure, dear Mr. Trump, are you sure, you know, you want to tell both Russia and China that if a tanker with their flag or doing their business or whatever, you know, comes near, you're gonna block it? I don't know. I get the sense that they're kind of working things out to defuse the blockade issue somehow. I don't understand what Trump is up to. He never thinks that far in advance. Maybe this will put some kind of pressure on, but the thing that would have been easy to do, the thing that would have oil prices lower than they are now, which you'd think would be in his interest. I mean, look, you've got this ceasefire of a couple of weeks where they can continue to negotiate. And that's what everybody said when, you know, when J.D. Vance came out and said, oh, we've reached an impasse. They can let us know whether they accept or decline our offer. We're not, you know, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people said, look, this is all, you know, negotiating. We'll wait and see. We got 2 weeks. We'll see what happens. I thought, you know, and meanwhile, Iran did plan to control traffic over the Strait of Hormuz. Which should have been clear to everybody if you looked at the way they worded their original consent to the ceasefire. They were like, yes, ships that coordinate with our military and do XYZ. It was totally clear. They were still wanted to charge money. Mm-hmm. That was the idea. And, you know, it would have been easy for Trump to finesse that, you know, without losing face. He could have said, look, we had thought they were going to close down. Now we're reading the fine print. Very sneaky of them. Well, anyway, when the ceasefire is over, they damn well better be doing things to our liking or there will be hell to pay. He could have done that, and then Iran would have let more and more traffic out because they're making money off of it. I think oil prices would be lower than they are. You'd think Trump would like that, but, you know, Trump's Trump. Maybe the blockade will put more pressure on Iran. I kind of doubt it, but whatever. You know, like part of the problem with Trump is just he has to generate a headline a day. You know, like yesterday, where did he attack the Pope? Or And so the day before he was Jesus, then he attacked the Pope. And I mean, it's just crazy. And by the way, Jesus would not attack the Pope. Let me just, you should make up your mind. Are you Jesus or are you attacking the Pope?
Why wouldn't Jesus attack the Pope?
Well, Protestants might say Jesus would attack the Pope, but Catholics certainly wouldn't.
Catholics wouldn't, yeah.
So,
Jesus like had run-ins with the religious authorities of his time. Like, he was not all peace and love.
He was a contrarian. He was, yeah.
Can you imagine Trump? I can't remember whether he actually said this or is this me imagining based on other things he said. But I think he might have thrown out the idea of doing a joint venture with Iran and, mm-hmm. Taking toll both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at one point
wouldn't that be a reasonable way to go about it? A joint blockade?
Well, I have long thought that some sort of kind of implicitly or explicitly authorized toll gate might be the way out of this. Because now Iran is demanding reparations, not unreasonably. The war was in flagrant violation of the UN Charter. We wiped out a ton of shit and may wipe out more, God forbid. But, politically, the U.S. is not, and Israel can't say, yeah, we're giving them some of our tax dollars. But they can collect this toll. It's not exorbitant. They're charging $2 million a tanker. That's a dollar a barrel, okay? The war has raised prices like $35, $40 a barrel, okay? So if Iran, if this ongoing deal of Iran collecting tolls wound up raising prices a dollar, two, even three a barrel, not a huge deal in the scheme of things compared to where we are now. You can imagine things where they even, some of the money goes to Gulf states to rebuild stuff that Iran blew up in retaliation for the U.S.-Israeli attack, since the Gulf states have U.S. bases there. And so on. You can imagine all kinds of things. And I think, well, Richard Haass, the former head of the Council on Foreign Relations, who was one of the first people, I think maybe the first person to propose a blockade, had that as some kind of end game, some kind of multilaterally controlled port. Now, I personally think Iran would like to control the strait more or less alone. It said in partnership with Oman. Well, even if Oman agreed to that, we know who the senior partner would be. And let me just emphasize, there's real virtue in that because Iran needs a lever that doesn't involve blowing shit up, okay? That's our in our interest. I mean, they have signaled that if Israel attacks them again, America attacks them again, they imperil the global economy, okay? We get that point. They feel they need it because who would trust a piece of paper with Donald Trump's or Netanyahu's signature? I mean, seriously, there's no way to guarantee. People talk about, we'll just agree to not attack them. What the fuck are you talking about? You literally attack them while negotiating with them. Okay.
Right.
It's just the inability of American foreign policy people to put themselves in the shoes of any adversary is completely mind blowing. But in this case, Iran feels they need a lever, like no piece of paper is going to do it. They need something they can do to you if Israel attacks. And I would rather that thing be just shut down traffic to the strait, oil prices go up, then start firing missiles at Israel and UAE and Saudi Arabia. Okay, that's like a good thing from our point of view, if you ask me, because Iran is absolutely going to demand some reassurance that they're not going to get attacked again. I'd rather that involve peaceful leverage. Now, in the long run, you would like to bring all this whole thing back into compliance with international law, maybe through creation of some international body, whatever. But we are in no position to complain about violations of international law. I'm sorry. We attack them illegally, and that's why we have a problem here. So,
but do you see this happening? Why can't that happen? Iran controls the strait and takes the toll and, gives 25% to Trump, whatever the current price of the passage is. And everybody's happy. I mean, Trump is
well,
happy.
And I think it might be a political problem for Iran, domestic political problem, to say we're giving some of this money to America. I don't know about that part. But look, the basic idea of formalizing a toll gate that benefits mainly Iran monetarily, I like. You know, and I just want people to understand that right now we're trying to bring the world back from the brink of true disaster of some kind, economic and or military. Not a bad thing for Iran to have this peaceful form of leverage. It's coercive, maybe it's thuggish, but it doesn't involve missiles, okay? If they can just shut the gate. And, I mean, behind it is the threat of missiles and drones. I mean, that's what people know they can do to tankers. And in a certain sense, I will say they would maintain that in any event. But so that's where we are on that. On the AI front, you know, as a lot of people heard, Anthropic has this new model. They haven't released it because it's so dangerous. Some people say this is marketing hype. I think mainly it's not, I'm afraid, and that's actually pretty clear. It may be somewhat marketing hype the way they're presenting it, but I don't think there's any doubt that the new model is of unprecedented power and does have the capacity to find and exploit vulnerabilities that were previously undetected in major operating systems, browsers, and so on. So Anthropic is now, without releasing it, making it available to the companies that maintain these pieces of infrastructure, Google, Microsoft, Cisco, and so on. And they say they're going to not release it until they can figure out a way to find it to do so safely. By the way, the
danger is to just to pinpoint, if they release it, if I get access to this, then I can use this model to hack a website.
Hack a website would be to put it mildly. I mean, in the extreme scenario, Nikita would be ruling the world. I mean, I don't mean you really could use this tool that way, but if you imagine, I mean, let's say that in Anthropic, they had this thing in that company, and Dario decided he wanted to bring down the world economy or do something major. Mm-hmm. They could probably do that with this tool. I think they probably could. I mean, they could, who knows, maybe blind networks of satellites, take down whole power systems, steal everyone's browsing histories, everyone's credit cards. I think if you had exclusive access to this tool and a team of people really understood the shit, yeah. You know, that kind of bad actor. And I would imagine that even a lone bad actor or a small rogue group of non-state actors who knew what they were doing could do real damage. I mean, that's what we're facing. You know, I guess I'll be ritually plugging my AI book, The God Test, until it comes out in June. You know, and I get into this, that, you know, this is part of the argument behind, this is one reason this stuff has to be governed internationally. No country is safe until it knows that no such tool is running loose in any state, in any nation. And so...
What do you see as the most probable scenario if this kind of tool does not become available to everybody, to rogue agents, but it is available to Anthropic itself? Similar tools are being developed by other AI companies.
Yeah.
Where does that lead if controls are in place, but it's just a ton of power in a few hands?
That's what some people have been warning about. I mean, including me, but also like the pause people, you know?
Right.
And look, I don't think that's crazy. I mean, one of my main sermons is just about, we have to do this internationally, because whatever we do, including PAWS, that has to be done internationally. Because if you say to the American AI companies, hey, how about a PAWS? They'll say, no, we can't because of China. And China doesn't want to PAWS as long as we, you know, and so on. So anyway, yeah, it's inevitable that you're going to get more and more super powerful things. In fact, this model, OpenAI, everyone says, is going to have a model about this powerful in a matter of months, if not weeks, because this is just, This model was trained on the NVIDIA Blackwell chips, the first model trained on them. And as a result of that, and then the number of those chips used and so on, and the amount of training data, it has apparently 10 trillion parameters. Now, my sense, you don't know for sure because they don't release the parameter count on proprietary models. My sense is that's like a tenfold increase. Okay, parameters is the number of interconnections among neurons. Neurons are these, you know, It's ultimately all math. They're these mathematical constructs, but they're nodes in the flow of information through the model. And So there are 10 trillion neuronal interconnections. And, OpenAI is going to have one soon. Google's going to have one before long. I don't know if they'll train on Blackwell per se, but this is where it's going. And, you know, by the way, this model apparently does, you know, extraordinarily well on a number of benchmarks, so far as we can tell. You know, I'm sure Anthropic is releasing those results selectively, but the people who know are saying, yeah, very appreciably more powerful.
So what happens then when these companies have this power? Like, is that scenario itself without the rogue agents entering the picture, is that worrisome? And
I think it's worrisome. That whether this got out of control, and it may have, who knows how good Anthropic security is? You know, who knows whether somebody has stolen the weights? But I think it's a little alarming that the question of whether this turns into a huge disaster for the world depends on, A, questions like that, like how good is their security? I don't know. I mean, there's no meaningful regulation, so far as I know, that actually involve we, the people, certifying, validating that security is good, A, and
well,
B.
This powerful system that can break into other systems should be able to protect itself too, right?
Well, in the long run, but remember, it came into existence before it could have been used to secure itself. I mean, you're talking about the whole security system surrounding the Anthropic lab. But the other thing is, you know, we're relying on the character of Dario Amodei. He seems like a person of, I think, true conscience, we can say, and Anthropic, maybe more than most, tries to do the right thing, fine. But the idea that the fate of the world, we are so reluctant to actually enact any policy of any consequence whatsoever at the national level, even let alone the international level, that we're just hoping these guys are great guys. Like Dario, Sam, Demis, I hope they turn out to be great guys, or, you know, but just in case, goodbye, it's been fun knowing you, you know? This is fucking nuts. This is fucking nuts. And, you know, and one... I mean, it's interesting that we're distracted by war at this moment. That's one reason. This has gotten a lot of attention, but not as much as it deserves. And anyway, but fortunately, Nikita's big idea this week is going to save us. How does that work, Nikita?
Right. Let's tie the two things together, war and AI. So here's one way to get into this. You've been saying this. AI poses a lot of threats. They can't be addressed on a national level. It has to be at an international level. And here's a critique of that position. When you start talking about threats and you bring this up to people in charge of the powerful technology, that puts them in the mindset, as you've been complaining, you know, China has been developing this and, you know, we have to be ahead. Same with like nuclear weapons, you know, if you're in a race to develop a more powerful weapon, even if you understand that the development of that weapon poses threats to the entire planet, you know, better you have it than the adversary or a potential adversary. Even with COVID, like that was the most straightforward, like global problem. Like we should really come together and solve this. You know, it had the opposite effects as well, where countries close their borders, protect their vaccines. Like we don't trust yours. We're gonna sell ours, because it's a mindset of, you know, you're threatened. We're talking about threats, so I'm gonna try to protect myself and see whether I can be more powerful than whoever is there is in the competition. So my proposal is turn this around. Instead of saying we have to address AI on an international level because of these threats, let's do a positive vision. Hey, let's work together on an AI project that would solve things that we're currently not able to solve very effectively, such as there are all of these conflicts, all of these wars going on. And it seems to me that mediation is, in principle, a kind of algorithmically, like it can be solved algorithmically. You can, it can be seen as a puzzle, as a math problem, as a game theory problem. You know, you have two adversaries, they're fighting. Each side has reasons to continue fighting. Here's what they're getting out of continuing the war. Here's what they're trying to avoid by continuing the war. Here are their, you know, there are all these inputs that you can put into a system. And a sufficiently smart system would come up with a bunch of scenarios like deals, like Trump was saying, you know, I've been doing deals my whole life. I'm just good at this. I'm going to solve all these wars because I'm great at doing deals. Turns out that was a little bit of an overestimation. but the theoretical, like, if there is a thing that is just very good at computing, coming up with best case scenarios for the parties involved, wouldn't that be a, like, it can be an effective, you know, algorithmic tool, an AI system that has, if you give it enough information, if it's trained on enough cases, it might just be good at presenting these scenarios that are most beneficial to the different sides. And you can imagine incentive structures where being a part of that project, both on the creation of it side and on using the thing, you know, get on this thing early and you get a benefit. If you manage to finish a conflict that's been simmering or going, like, you know, maybe Armenia and Azerbaijan, like they've been trying to stop fighting and not diminish the chance of the war restarting. Mm-hmm. They seem to be going in that direction. It's been years of arguing about specific wording in different points of this agreement. They would be happy maybe to use the system that is trying to grow and get more, you know, clients. And you start even smaller. Maybe it's like a scenario, you know, it starts out as a little startup that builds on small cases of like business disputes just trains its muscle on like figuring out these puzzles in lower stakes.
So would this be binding arbitration? They would agree in advance to accept the verdict, perhaps by virtue of the idea that, okay, this is not humans. This is not, so we don't have to worry about the adjudicatory panel being biased in favor of the U.S. In turn by virtue of the U.S.'s inordinate influence over this particular international institution. This is an objective arbiter, and so both parties agree in writing, you know, and swear on, you know, a stack of holy texts or whatever. Is that the idea?
I think that's unlikely to happen.
Because like right now, between us and Iran, a lot of ideas are out there. You know, humans are good at generating a multitude of ideas. I mean, if you look at all the ideas generated by the Iranian side and people partial to that side and the American side and people partial to it and American magazines and Middle Eastern magazines, blah, blah, blah. You could have an array of proposals. It wouldn't be hard to generate that. And then if it doesn't have to be binding, if you're saying there really is a zone that would be acceptable to both, Why not just do that? Have humans produce a spectrum of solutions, and you have Iran and the U.S. say, okay, I'll take this one, this one, this one, and then see where the overlap is, right? I mean, I don't know if I'm making my point, but
I think this is theoretically, that's how it would go, right? And that's what people are trying to
okay,
do.
There's but usually. I guess I'm saying we don't necessarily need machines for that. I mean, bargaining. And, you know, by the way, you said you can, you know, this is in theory game theory. Well, yeah, there's a whole literature on this, on geopolitics from a game theoretical point of view. Some of the pioneers were like Thomas Schelling, one of the first people to emphasize that war is a non-zero-sum game because it's often lose-lose. And, you know, so that's there. But I guess, you know, in the whole history of humankind, the most effective and almost only reliable and remotely just solution to the problem of consequential disagreement among parties has been, in a certain sense, binding adjudication in a nation's court system. That's just part of the deal. You're a citizen. You're buying into binding binding adjudication. You get accused of a crime. This is how we select the jury and the judge that will decide, and you accept that in advance. Same with civil suits. And there have been, you know, some of the greatest initiatives, and in some cases, if temporarily successful initiatives in international affairs, have been binding arbitration. Before the World Trade Organization fell apart, Recently, partly due to the influence of America and in some cases specifically Donald Trump, but not exclusively, one of its pioneering features was an actual adjudicatory body that could levy penalties. They were in the form of authorizing the party found to have a just grievance to levy punitive sanctions against another party. So in other words, it wasn't like the international governance system itself levies the penalty, but it authorized the penalty from one party to be exacted on the other. And like that was a big deal, but it fell apart for various reasons. But one thing about it was it had human judges. And one thing you could ask is, If the judges were AI, and because of that, and this is a big if, but if that inspired trust in the parties, and if it should, that's another big if, maybe that could lead such a system to stay intact longer. But I guess my question to you is, if it's not binding arbitration, what is the innovation here?
So first, let me say, I think I misunderstood your question when you asked about binding. I thought you're saying binding in advance, like before starting the negotiation, you say that you're going to accept the verdict.
That is what I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's going to be a tough sell. Maybe by the, you know, when the system grows sufficiently and it has a good track record and an army of robot dogs with guns and stuff, it'll be more powerful like that. But I think you start with just working on the negotiation process. And I think AI can be effective there for a couple of reasons. One, it's not automatic that there would be more trust in AI than in human intermediaries. But I think if it's set up in the right way, it's an international project. It's not an American company that's giving you this solution, but anybody, any country can join and send their, mm-hmm. you know, computer people to work on this and diplomat people to work on this. That would be one angle, and you know, it needs to be transparent, the system itself.
By the way, these systems tend not to be, but I mean, large language models. Well, that's a whole complicated question, the degree of transparency. By the way, that's another alarming thing about Mythos that I might get into. They kind of screwed up the training, so it's less transparent than it might be. It was just a mistake. And now it's here. They've done this, you know, they've put all this money into it. It's not like they can just, let's do it again. They fucked up. They didn't. Maybe we'll get into the details in overtime. But this is what I mean. It's like, oh, well, we're trusting you. Whatever. You fucked up. The world's going to end. Oh, well. Whatever. Anyway.
Let's talk about this in overtime. But what I was saying is, I think the reason AI may be more effective in mediation is, I mean, what you're having now when you have these rounds of negotiations, it's teams of people that meet, you know, if it's going well every couple of weeks, you know, Ukrainians are talking to the US, Russians are talking to the US, then they go in between. It's many hours of human to human interactions where mm-hmm. emotions are present, distrust of the other side is present. And, you know, you do this, whatever, 8-hour session, and there's little communication, then there is, they go between, there is, the process is slow, it's step by step, and it's, there's a lot of mistrust on at every step, and misinterpretation and misrepresentation of the positions. You know, they misunderstood what we agreed to, kind of thing. With AI,
well, that's especially characteristic of Trump. I mean, if you do it the Obama way, where you actually have veteran negotiators, you wind up ironing all that out. But and it doesn't, and you don't get these huge obstacles in the meantime, the way you do with Trump. Like, oh, I thought it didn't include Lebanon. Well, Lebanon's a significant country. Maybe you should have worked that out in advance. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. But so what I'm imagining with this scenario is, you have a team of people working with the system at home, at the computer, negotiate, moving. It's like a game you're playing. You're trying to get a better deal for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's not the slow step-by-step who's going to call whom first. Mm-hmm. It's a process has started. And your team is every day. People show up to work and they work with the system trying to get a better deal. And the process is only ever finished if the two sides do reach an agreement. But it can be, you know, continuous. A lot of the work in computing the thing, coming up with like, okay, we got new input from the Ukrainian side. Let's mesh this with the input we got from the Russian side. Come up with a bunch of suggestions. This is sent to both sides, mm-hmm. another round of negotiation, and the computer acts, the network, as an intermediary trying to just accelerate the process of finding a solution that's written down in plain language, mm-hmm. In, you know, legalese kind of formulations. So basically accelerate the process, which is what AI is good at, like workflows, just getting faster with this. Like when I'm talking mm-hmm. to a computer program, or what I'm seeing in my own work, my relationship with Claude Code is I'm trying to develop, you know, workflows, loops, steps of mm-hmm. action, where a lot of the complicated stuff can be done by the computer itself. And then when it needs my input is when it, you know, asks for it. But because a lot of the work is done by the computer, and because we're getting better, like I'm trying to get better at developing these workflows themselves, these cycles of operation, mm-hmm. it just becomes way faster. Mm-hmm. And so if there is a deal to be struck, it seems like just that negotiation process can be sped up significantly with a smart system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so before I reply to all that, and also before I explain the unfortunate lack of an unplanned lack of transparency in Anthropic's new model, and apparently irreversible lack of transparency. Why don't we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. You can go to the nonzero.org site, where, by the way, there's also a piece that I posted last Friday on the connection, a different kind of connection between the Iran war and the Mythos thing. You can go to that. You can leave comments in a couple of places on YouTube, but you can also leave them under the video on our site. And that tends to be, you know, a more kind of unified, cohesive conversation when that develops. Mm-hmm. And that is available to paid subscribers. And that's one reason it's you know, pretty civil and unified and cohesive. So we encourage people to do that, to become non-zero, full-fledged non-zero members. And also we like to think that our mission is worth supporting. Anything, and then, Nikita, before we talk about other things we're going to talk about in overtime, anything you'd add to that?
We should also mention that the paid subscribers get 50% discount on how many newsletters is that now? 7?
Let's see. There's, you tell me if I forget any. There's Foreign Exchange's Derek Davison's, Peter Beinart's newsletter, Paul Bloom's Small Potatoes newsletter, Glenn Lowry's newsletter, Mark Leon Goldberg's Global Dispatches, and
Seneca by Kaiser Kuo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So all of those have a paid option. And if you're a paid subscriber to Non-Zero, you can get a one-year subscription at a 50% discount to any of them. Details on the homepage of nonzero.org. You'll see the big kind of 50% off coupon there. What else do we have time to talk to? I want to pursue this, talk about the transparency issue. Maybe say a little about one of these biographies I've been listening to. I also listened to one about Mark Twain. Well, I'm gonna talk about one person at least, probably at least two of the following: John Adams, Adolf Hitler, Mark Twain, Dennis Hassabis. I'm gonna talk about at least two of those people and find some connection between them.
I want to hear about Hitler.
Yeah, the Hitler Twain. No, there's Hitler is sui generis. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. But if you don't, thanks for following us this far. Now we go into overtime.